books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we've got part two of our review of the year. Coming up today, we'll hear from the Pulitzer Prize-winning book James by Percival Everett. We'll hear from David Saloy, the Booker winner 2025 for Flesh. We'll hear from the Carnegie Medal for Writing winner Margaret MacDonald and the Carnegie Medal for Writing Shadowers Award. We'll hear about King of Nothing by Nathaniel Lesore. And we'll pay tribute to two authors we lost last year, Dame Stella Remington and Frederick Forsyth. That's all coming up on today's part two of Read On's Review of the Year. Percival Everett said the idea for James came to him while he was playing tennis. He stopped and thought, I wonder if anyone has written Huck Finn from Jim's point of view. The subsequent novel, James, a retelling of the adventures of Huckleberry Finn from the perspective of Huck's enslaved companion, won the National Book Award for Fiction and was also on the Booker shortlist. The audio version, available commercially and also from RNIB Talking Books, is read by Dominic Hoffman.
That evening I sat down with Lizzie and six other children in our cabin and gave a language lesson. These were indispensable. Safe movement through the world depended on mastery of language, fluency. The young ones sat on the packed dirt floor, and I was on one of our two homemade stools. The hole in the roof pulled the smoke from the fire that burned in the middle of the shack. Papa, why do we have to learn this? White folks expect us to sound a certain way, and it can only help if we don't disappoint them, I said. The only ones to suffer when they are made to feel inferior is us. Perhaps I should say, when they don't feel superior. So let's pause to review some of the basics. Don't make eye contact, a boy said. Right, Virgil. Never speak first, a girl said. That's correct, February, I said. Lizzie looked at the other children, and then back to me. Never address any subject directly when talking to another slave, she said. What do we call that? I asked. Together, they said, signifying. Excellent. They were happy with themselves, and I let that feeling linger.
Now, we last spoke in 2022 when The Trees was on the shortlist, and you said you were the last person you should ask for a synopsis of your book. But can we try and can we jump off with your description of the novel James?
Well, this one is slightly easier to synopsize it. It's ostensibly a retelling of the story of Adventures of Huckleberry Finn as told from the point of view of the enslaved man, Jim.
Let's try some situational translation, something extreme first. You're walking down the street, and you see that Mrs. Holliday's kitchen is on fire. She's standing in her yard, her back to her house, unaware. How do you tell her? Fire, fire, January said. Direct, and that's almost correct, I said. The youngest of them, lean and tall 5-year-old Rachel, said, Lordy, miss him. Looky there. Perfect, I said. Why is that correct? Lizzie raised her hand. Because we must let the whites be the ones who name the trouble. And why is that? I asked. February said, because they need to know everything before us, because they need to name everything. Good. Good. You all are really sharp today. Okay. Let's imagine now that it's a grease fire. She's left bacon unattended on the stove. Mrs. Holliday is about to throw water on it. What do you say? Rachel? Rachel paused. Missums, that water gonna make it worse. Of course, that's true. But what's the problem with that? Virgil said, you're telling her she's doing the wrong thing. I nodded. So, what should you say? Lizzie looked at the ceiling and spoke while thinking it through. Would you like for me to get some sand? Correct approach, but you didn't translate it. She nodded. Oh, Lord, Missums, ma'am. You want for me to get some sand? Good.
You don't shy away from the language of Twain, language we might balk at today. Is that a deliberate choice?
Well, it's a deliberate choice insofar that as I'm a writer who attempts to tell the truth, of course, you're referring to that particularly unfortunate six-letter word that everyone's afraid to say in our culture, even in historical context. But the word was used in the 19th century, and it tells us about the people who are using it. So in that way, the word not only fits, but is necessary. Replacements won't serve.
What did you think of the sanitized versions of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn that came out a few years back that removed that word?
Well, I mean, I understand the impulse, the sensitivity that would prompt someone to do it, but it's woefully inadequate to replace that word with the word slave. It changes the story. It softens the story. The terror of the story, the sadness of the story is lost. That word does have a lot of power, and it does a lot of work in the text.
I've heard it described as a well-intentioned act of cultural vandalism.
Yeah, that's very good.
Yes. Now, how many times did you read Huck Finn before writing James?
Well, the exercise for freeing myself from Twain's text was to read it 15 times in a row. I learned after 15 times that 11 probably would have been enough.
Did you love it or hate it by the end?
I fairly hated it by then. I accomplished my goal, which was to immerse myself in that world and to commit it to memory. And I'd also completely divorced myself from all of the words.
Gets some. It's hard to say. This from Glory, the oldest child, the S's. That's true, I said. And it's okay to trip over it. In fact, it's good. You want for me to get some sand, Miss Holiday? What if they don't understand? Lizzie asked. That's okay. Let them work to understand you. Mumble sometimes, so they can have the satisfaction of telling you not to mumble. They enjoy the correction and thinking you're stupid. Remember, the more they choose to not want to listen, the more we can say to one another around them.
Now, is it true that Twain abandoned this novel halfway through and only came back to it for a bit of a payday?
I think it was 7 or 8 years that he left work on the novel, and it was probably three quarters done, which explains there's sort of a marked difference where he comes back. The tone has changed. The novel's not quite the same. There are any number of reasons that this could be true, partly because of the distance from it, but also perhaps more mercenary reasons. The reinsertion of Tom Sawyer might be to gain a larger readership.
Do you think Jim's intelligence was already present in Twain's work, although a bit hidden?
No. I think that his humanity and his kindness are certainly on display. But the fact that he is so superstitious and subject to the whims and practical jokes of this 14-year-old boy, you know, it plays into the 19th and persisting 20th century depiction of the slave as superstitious and simple-minded.
That's a sort of display Jim puts on when he's being Jim, because there's a scene early in the book where James is teaching his children how to code switch, how to talk like the white people expect.
Yes.
The culture cultural differences are enormous, but it reminds me in an opposite way of the Scots language. You know, we were always told we couldn't speak that way, you shouldn't speak that way, you know, it's guttural, it's common, you shouldn't speak like that. But Jim is actually encouraging his children to do it so they would be safe.
Yes, and I think that's what oppressed, enslaved, imprisoned people do quite naturally. Always have, and they always will. They find ways to speak to each other. They don't allow entry of their oppressors, but also they find ways of safe passage through the through a hostile world.
Why did God set it up like this? Rachel asked. With them as masters and us as slaves. There is no God, child. There's religion, but there's no God of theirs. Their religion tells that we will get our reward in the end. However, it apparently doesn't say anything about their punishment. But when we're around them, we believe in God. Oh, Lordy, Lord, we's be believing. Religion is just a controlling tool they employ and adhere to when convenient. There must be something, Virgil said. I'm sorry, Virgil. You might be right. There might be some higher power, children, but it's not their white God. However, the more you talk about God and Jesus and heaven and hell, the better they feel. The children said together, and the better they feel, the safer we are. February, translate that. The more better they feels, the more safer we be. Nice.
Now, James is a literate man, but at that time, am I right in saying it was illegal for a slave to be literate?
I don't know if it was illegal. I can't say that. It certainly wasn't welcome, and it certainly would have been a danger because they would be perceived as dangerous. You know, there's a reason that fascist regimes rush to burn books when they come to power, and that's because books are scary to them. Education is scary to them.
Now, there's humor in the book and sort of contrasts with its serious undertones. How do you use humor as a tool in literature?
Well, this, of course, is a lesson I learned from Mark Twain. I am an admirer of his humor. When you make someone laugh, when you can get them laughing, you've done something to them. You've relaxed them. They're in a slightly more vulnerable state. It's almost an expression of trust. And once they open up in that way, you can do other things to them, some more serious things.
Now, there are a number of different dialects in the book, a number of different voices. Were you responsible for the casting of Dominic Hoffman as the audiobook narrator?
Responsible. I heard him and approved it. I don't know if I'm responsible. I'm happy to take credit for that because he does such a wonderful job. So let's say that yes, I'm responsible for
But
it.
now it's available in audio and in Braille. Is it important that it's now accessible to people who, for whatever reason, can't read print?
Oh yes, by all means. I have a really expansive idea of reading. And it doesn't mean seeing words on a page. It's receiving story in whatever way one can.
Now, one thing we won't get if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of the book?
Well, the American cover is simply the word James with a very large J that extends from the top of the page to the bottom. And that's an homage to Joyce's Ulysses. When I was a kid, a teenager, it had a very large U, and I always remembered that. It struck me. And on the British cover, there is, of course, the title James, but then there's a depiction of a man, ostensibly an enslaved man, obviously on a trek.
Now, you've had great success in Hollywood with American fiction coming from Erasure. I don't know if there's another way to say this, but have you sold James?
Yes, and it is unfortunate language that I have sold James. Yes, Steven Spielberg will be producing the film.
Huck caught me as I was hauling sacks of chicken feed from the buckboard to the shed in the back of the Widow Douglas's house. He was studying on something intently, and I could tell He wanted to talk. "What be on your mind, Huck?" "Prayers," he said. "Do you pray?" "Yes, sir. I prays all the time." "What do you pray for?" he asked. "I prays for all sort of things. I pray once that the little girl February would get better when she be sick." "Did it work?" "Well, she be better now."
That whole interview can be heard in Read On episode 424. Now, from the slave James to the King of Nothing with Nate Lesore, winner of the Shadowers Award at last year's Carnegie's.
Yeah, no, King of Nothing is the story of Anton, and it opens with Anton, who is in detention for fighting again, and his mum confiscates a Wi-Fi password until his behaviour improves, and so she makes him join the Happy Campers. And on a camping trip, Anton has his life saved by the nerdiest kid in school, and so Anton decides to pay the nerdy kid back by making him cool and trying to give him a kind of personality makeover. But in the end, Anton ends up, you know, learning about himself and his own journey and his own masculinity. Just a fun story of unlikely friendships. It's a bit of a buddy comedy, and it tackles things like, you know, the toxic masculinity that we're seeing a lot of.
Yeah, because Anton's kind of obsessed with how others see him, but Matthew really, really doesn't care, does he?
No. And I think that's what I love about writing there. Dynamics is, you know, outside of, you know, the kind of fun comedic frustration that Anton has for the eternally positive, optimistic Matthew, there is, you know, the kind of underlying self-loathing that Anton has as well, that is, you know, juxtaposed to the point where Anton's journey is about accepting himself and acknowledging, you know, his own prejudices and you know, that kind of, you know, confronting his own mentality. And Matthew is quite a good soundboard for that, because like you said, like, he is completely unself-conscious and unapologetically himself. I think that's where a lot of my favorite scenes were, them kind of like bouncing off each other.
"You almost stepped in stinging nettles. I felt obliged to warn you." He points over at a small cluster of plants on the ground, several meters away. "They can leave a dastardly rash, and I don't carry dock leaves in my first aid kit. I don't pretend to know what that means. I do know that was the most dramatic overreaction I've ever witnessed." "You mean those nettles all the way over there?" "Depth perception is no joke, Anton. My great uncle Gregory once got hit in the temple by a frisbee because he couldn't judge the distance. He tried to duck, but it was too late. He died 12 years later," Matthew says, bowing his head all somber. "Why did a frisbee injury take 12 years to kill him? I'm caught off guard." "It didn't. He died of a chest infection when he was 93. But that's neither here nor there. The fact is, he was loved. And he had poor depth perception, like I said." I almost respond, but ultimately decide against it. That's what he wants, a back and forth. I ignore him and go back to my phone. Once he's finished building the tent, I look up and am able to take in the true devastation of where I found myself. The sun is setting now, and the trees that surround us are getting darker and harder to see through. The grass is matted and clumpy, and everything is so boring to look at, like quinoa. This is worse than my worst nightmare. The tent that we're sleeping in is a two-man tent, apparently. But it looks like someone draped an anorak over a plastic chair.
Yeah, can't even insult him properly because they call him moist.
Yeah. What do you call him? He says, "Yeah, you're moist." And he says, yeah, moist like lemon drizzle or the nose of a puppy. And, you know, he takes everything as a compliment. Yeah, and he's kind of impenetrable in that way, Matthew.
Now, like Steady for This, were you looking to write a book that a young version of you would have loved to read? A better representation in a book?
Yeah, I mean, I can only really write honestly because I'm not creative enough to completely fabricate characters and scenarios and that. And I was always told that you need to write what you know. And so that's kind of like the basis for everything that I write now. Yeah, it needs to be grounded in real life. And inadvertently, I think it has become the case where I would have loved to read these books because of the representation when I was younger. All I really had back as a teenager was, you know, Mallory Blackman. I think that was the first time it was cool to be writing as a teen, and that is because of the representation and being able to finally see myself in books. And so I think it is that I have to write honestly first, and I think kids who are growing up the same way I grew up are seeing themselves in books, I think, just because I don't really know how to write anything else.
Was it quite a tough thing to pull off, making Anton quite unlikable at the start but then getting the readers on his side as we go along?
Yeah. I mean, it was, and it wasn't in the way that Anton. So the way his voice came about after Steady Footers, my editors said do something completely different from Grouse. And so I thought, well, what is Grouse is the main character in my first book, Steady Footers, and he's a bit of a lovable oaf who we kind of learn along with. And so I thought, what's the opposite of Grouse? Would be, you know, someone cynical and grumpy and sarcastic. I know lots of people like that. And so the voice of Anton was based on my younger brother, who is all of those things. You know, he's very grumpy and pessimistic. And he was kind of the perfect template for the Anton voice, you know. And I thought, well, I do love annoying my younger brother for those reasons. And I annoy him with my optimism, and so, you know, it was in a way, as I was writing, Matthew is quite an extreme version of myself, and Anton is quite an extreme version of my brother. And so I didn't feel like it was a chore making such an unlikable character. It was just, you know, again, it was just, well, I know this voice because I'm so used to it after all these years.
That whole interview with Nate is available in Read On episode 429.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Frederick Forsyth, the author who turned his adventures as a journalist and his work with MI6 into best-selling thrillers, has died after a brief illness, aged 86. He visited the RNIB Talking Book Studios a number of times, once to record a small non-fiction tale he wrote for us to help fundraise for our re-archiving project when we turned all our old quarter-inch tape recordings into digital files. He also popped in to record small messages of support like this.
Now, sight loss can happen to anyone at any time, and the RNIB is there to provide support when it does happen. Talking Books is described as one of the RNIB's most important services. To find out more about Talking Books or to support the RNIB campaign, visit www.rnib.org.uk.
On one visit in the early 2010s, I asked Frederick Forsyth why he supported Talking Books.
Well, I think two reasons. Firstly, I mean, I started reading as a boy and became completely smitten by the idea of reading, and I've never stopped reading. So I have a sort of personal obsession with reading. But the second thing, I think, obviously, is that I would just shudder with horror if someone said, you're going to have your eyes taken away. You'll never see anything again. I mean, I think this must be one of the worst sort of maledictions. And so if anyone can do to help, those of us who have eyes, and I've just had operations on mine to give me back that 20/20 vision I used to have as a youngster. And I just think that if there's anything I can do to help people who have no sight, who want nevertheless to be entertained or informed or whatever via reading but can't read, this is the way. It's through the ears instead of through the eyes. And I do believe that you learn a lot of things through books, but mostly I find that you can retain if you've read it. Thus, I can retain what was in a book. I may well have forgotten what was in a film a few days after seeing it. But books, the written word on paper has something to do with clarity and memorability, and I can remember things that I've read years and years after I read them. Stuff I read at school, I can still recite poems I read at school. But I can't recall something that I saw visually a few days ago. So for me, reading is the way of educating a youngster and of retaining one's own interest in what's going on around one. I read newspapers, magazines.
Well, you mentioned newspapers and you were a journalist in the 60s. What brought around the change of career and brought you to write The Day of the Jackal?
That's the best motivation probably that ever was. I was skint. I came back from I was a war correspondent, first a foreign correspondent, then a war correspondent, and I was down in Africa covering for 2.5 years, particularly violent and tragic African war, the Biafra War. And I came back from there I found myself back in London, 31 years old, absolutely broke, no job, no prospects of a job, no car, no flat. I was actually crashing on the sofa of a mate, and I thought, what on earth do I do now? Well, answer, are you going to find some way of getting out of debt? So I was so naive, I thought that you wrote a novel and then sold it like a dozen eggs. Didn't realize, I didn't know about royalties and contracts and foreign rights and all that. I didn't even know anything about that. So I thought, well, what do I know? What can I write about? I know, what about that idea I had all those years ago in Paris when I was covering for Reuters the various attempts to assassinate Charles de Gaulle? And so I just sat down, untutored, instinctive, unlearned, and wrote. I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. I wrote on an old wallpaper table in this mate's flat. He went off to work. I sat down with a battered and much-traveled portable typewriter, rolled in a few sheets of paper and started typing. And I just typed and typed and typed. And in 35 days, I had a manuscript. And amazingly, it is amazing, really. It's still not a line, not a word was changed. It's still exactly the same today. And I don't know how many millions it sold, but an awful lot. So a miracle, a minor miracle.
And did you imagine that a career as a writer could be so dangerous? Because you have been bugged, you've been interrogated, you've been shot at.
Well, yes, some of these exploits actually preceded the novel writing. But what happened with The Jackal was that it was made very plain to me when The Jackal began to succeed that one of the reasons people liked it, apparently, was that it had a lot of explained technology in it. Instead of just saying, oh, he reached into his pocket and produced a British passport, forged. I thought, hey, wait a minute, how do you get one? So I made it my business to find out, and I put it in the novel, and people ever since have been saying, that's how the so-and-sos get false British passports. So and then I got lumbered, in a sense, with this reputation for, hey, you know, there's lots and lots of technology, and it's all explained. And this is the guy you've got to read if you want to know how spies work and how this works. So I got sort of really lumbered with the obligation to do a lot of research for each book and get it right, so that if I do get something wrong, boy, do I get letters.
Do you think the audio version of your books adds... Well, in fact, have you ever listened to any of the audio versions of your books?
Do you know, I haven't. It's funny. Once I've delivered them, after, say, the second or third read-through to the publisher, I don't read them again, and I've never listened to one. So, no, there was a man on that program Mastermind some time ago, and his speciality subject was the novels of Frederick Forsyth. I thought, this I have got to listen to. Wow. He creamed me. He wiped the floor with me. He knew little characters back in books 25, 30 years ago that I'd long forgotten, and there he was answering one after the other. I was thinking, you know, this guy... Anyway, he beat the hell out of me.
Now, that's surprising because The Afghan was a sequel to The Fist of God. Did you read any of it before?
It wasn't
you
quite a sequel. It was the same man, but it was a different exploit. I mean, Mike Martin was I'd invented a question about that, but I did know that at the time of the first Gulf War, I believe we had three special forces officers in the country who could actually were so fluent in Arabic that they could pass for Arabs among Arabs, which, you know, that is so to speak, the pinnacle. If you can pass for French among the French, or German among the Germans, or Arab for an Arab among Arabs, you know, that is, you don't get more fluent than that. That's it, because it's everything. It's the accent, the gestures, the vocabulary, the slang, all sorts of things come into passing for something you're not. But anyway, I thought, well, we'll introduce this man into that book, which was called The Fist of God. And then years later, I think it's nearly 10, I thought, I need a special forces officer who can pass for an Arab. Well, I have one. His name's Mike Martin. He must surely now be in retirement. So sure enough, he was in retirement. I got him out of retirement to be the hero of The Afghan. But then I've done it more recently with The Cobra, which is later on. I've resuscitated two characters from Avenger, one CIA man and one ex-Vietnam war hero, both who appeared in Avenger and have now reappeared in The Cobra.
Now, you mentioned The Cobra, and I believe the research for that book was particularly hairy.
What happened was I felt I had to go to a particularly awful little failed state, now become a narco state, on the west coast of Africa, called Guinea-Bissau. Formerly the colony Portuguese Guinea, and wrecked by 20 years of war of independence, followed by years more of civil war, just a gutted ruin of a country that is now a major importer of cocaine. The stuff comes from Colombia across the Atlantic to this place, Guinea-Bissau, and then it's broken down into smaller packages and then smuggled north through the Sahara or over the Sahara and into southern Europe and eventually, I suppose, you know, to Mayfair or Edinburgh, for God's sake. So that's how it gets into this country. I thought I must have a look at this place and these people and the Colombian drug lords who infest the place. So I went down there. What I didn't know was that while I was actually airborne on the airliner from Lisbon to Guinea, a coup d'etat took place. And I landed right in the middle of it. So I swear I had not come for the coup. I'd come for the cocaine. But I got mixed up. I just became an inadvertent witness to a rather bloody coup d'etat.
Wouldn't research be easier with a book or a laptop, maybe in front of the fire, maybe with a brandy?
Yes, it would be safer assuming the brandy. But then there are things about a place that you can get which you're not going to get online. There are anecdotes, people you meet, and the anecdotes they tell you, and if you might get an interview with the chief of police or something. Well, he can tell you things that you're not going to get online at all, and that virtually no other researcher would get, because they wouldn't know what they were to ask for, what to look for. And there's a way of going to a place and learning about it. Small details, the names of streets, and you can probably get that off Google Earth, but you can't get the interviews and you can't get the special effects, so to speak, of a place. So where I have to describe a place that somebody else may not have been, I try to go there, or 90% of the time I try to go there. But going to Guinea-Bissau was probably being a bit stupid, actually, because apart from the coup d'etat, I also picked up a blood poisoning infection in the left leg. They nearly took my leg off. Not down there, back in Harley Street. I got to Harley Street just in time, and they poured industrial quantities of antibiotics into me and saved the leg. But I thought, enough's enough. My wife said, "You're insane." So I said, "You're probably right, darling." But anyway, I did it, and you know, so what do you if you read The Cobra, the bit about the coup d'etat, I thought, well, as I've witnessed one, I might as well put it in the book. So I put it in the book. The whole description of Guinea-Bissau in the book is absolutely spot on accurate. So may I advise you, cancel the vacation. You won't like it.
And finally, why should people support RNIB and RNIB Talking Books?
Well, I support any group of people like yourselves who are trying to help someone. Why indeed? I don't know. I suppose it's about that part of all our spirits that says, hey, you know, I am actually doing quite well. And if there is a God, and some people still believe that there is, despite Mr. Dawkins, then the good Lord has been very, very, very decent to me, and he's given me a cracking pair of eyes and good ears and a decent body and so on, or not, as the case may be. But those, I think, of us who are reasonably fit with good vision and hearing, etc., we have a feeling inside ourselves, at least I do, that you know, there are some people who just don't, and there's a moral obligation to help. So if people can't see, I think we who can should say, you lucky so-and-so, and help this guy. And that's what our NIB does. We have tens of thousands of people in this country who are genuinely completely blind. They cannot see, but they can enjoy life. And part of that enjoyment comes from listening to cracking good stories, not through the eyes, but through the ears. Hence, the Talking Books program of RNIB is well, well worth supporting. So I urge you to do it if you can.
The best-selling thriller author Frederick Forsyth, who has died at the age of 86. The winner in 2025 for the Carnegie Medal for Writing was Margaret MacDonald. Here she is on her book, Glasgow Boys.
So Glasgow Boys is about two boys called Banjo and Finlay. And when we first meet them, it's been 3 years since they've spoken, and they are in completely different sort of stages and places in their lives. Finlay is starting university. He's studying nursing at Glasgow University. And Banjo is with a new foster family in East Kilbride, and he's in his last year of high school. So they're sort of undertaking these huge transitional periods, but at the same time they are thinking about one another and what happened 3 years ago when they roomed together in a foster care home, a group home. And the novel sort of slowly unravels what happened while it brings them sort of closer together and into one another's orbit.
Now, as with all the Carnegie interviews, we won't go into spoiler territory at all. So yeah. Look at the first few chapters of the books and the writing process. But you wouldn't normally put these two together, the noisy Banjo and the more reserved Finlay. Was that a nice idea to have them rooming together to kind of force that connection?
Yeah, that was the initial idea of the novel. I wanted two characters that were essentially chalk and cheese, would have absolutely no reason to know one another, no reason to give each other the time of day kind of thing, and forced into this close proximity situation wherein, yeah, I mean, their sort of barriers are slowly pulled down and they sort of learn their similarities are a little bit more profound than their differences. And despite the fact that they... I mean, I don't know how much I can spoiler if this even is a spoiler, but despite the fact they don't spend a lot of time together in the care home, it's still like a hugely significant part of their life. And yeah, I really wanted to explore love in all its forms outside of the family, biological family unit, and the ways in which like people can make a difference and leave a lasting like mark on you. Yeah, that was very much the purpose of their characters.
There is love in all its forms in the book, straight, queer, fraternal, paternal, platonic. Is it essentially at its heart a love story?
I'd love to think of it as a love story. And I really like when people catch on and connect to that part of the novel. I mean, I've often heard Banjo and Finlay called the secret third thing between like lovers and friends. And I quite like that. I think, honestly, like platonic love is very complicated and nuanced. I really think oftentimes in young adults specifically, and you know, in the romance genre, it's often that, you know, a romantic partner is very much the sort of sole focus of a character. And I think that's maybe not true to life. Obviously Banjo and Finlay have romantic partners and they're hugely important to them and their life, but they're not the only people in their life. So yeah, definitely platonic love was a major focus.
Now, there's a lot of lived experience in the book, but you yourself weren't in care. Did you consult with a care worker?
We did. We hired an authenticity reader, a man called John Rideau. He is a children's therapist and he grew up in care. So his insight was really, really obviously vital to the novel. But that was a sort of voluntary undertaking that we did, me and Faber, for the novel as we were editing it. And it was really great for John to like catch on to sort of small details that might have been a little bit inauthentic and just like how to sensitively handle Banjo and Finlay and their stories. But I was obviously delighted that John really connected with Banjo and Finlay, and he sort of thought that it was very well done and delicately handled, which again, I feel like I'm talking myself up, but I'm just very delighted, and that really meant a lot to me. It was a very special thing to have experienced.
You can talk yourself up as much as you want. It's a great book. Now, like many colleagues here at RNIB of other conditions, along with sight loss, they were shielding during COVID, and I believe that was the case for you as well.
Yes, yes. What a time. What a time to be alive, shielding in my bedroom of my parents' house, not able to work. I was completing a master's degree, which I think did keep me sane because it gave me something to do other than just watch Netflix. But yeah, all of those experiences were poured into the novel. I was shielding for 5 weeks, but because my mum and dad are vital workers, essential workers, they had to work. So essentially, I couldn't be anywhere near my parents or my family, my brothers, my sisters. My brother had moved out. My sister was still in the house. So they like left trays outside my door of like my food and stuff, and they'd have to vacate the kitchen and like basically press themselves to the wall of the living room if I was going to go into the kitchen to like just get anything. So it was such a bizarre time in my life, and I'm really, really close to my family, so there was that impact. And then also just the loss of like any physical touch, physical connection was really jarring for me. And yeah, like I was a bit mentally low, and I think during that period I sort of learned about this sort of touch starvation, and especially with kids in the care system who go through that. So it was like something that I really wanted to highlight in the novel.
That's what I was actually going to ask next. Is that where Banjo and Finlay's desire for a hug came from?
It is, honestly. You don't think that it's that important, I guess. When I was researching it, I had learned that like human beings for maintenance need about 4 hugs a day, but children need about 9. And I don't know why that kind of broke my heart a little bit. And I just thought about, yeah, the characters I've been writing, Banjo and Finlay, going through the care system. And I thought, I actually really want to highlight the importance of touch and the lack of it that they've had in their life.
Did you plot a lot of the book out beforehand, or did Banjo and Finlay sort of lead the way?
I would say Banjo and Finlay led the way. I sort of constructed a plot around them as opposed to constructing characters around a plot, which is probably quite a unique way to do it. And, you know, the structure and the pacing was kind of everywhere. And I think my editors really, really helped me with that. But obviously we had the characters there and they loved them. And yeah, I think their voice, Banjo's, came really naturally to me. I could just really like sink into his Scots banter. Finlay was a little tougher because he is quite emotionally unavailable, even to his author. So I really had to like draw out a lot of what he was thinking and feeling. But I did definitely like pour all of my energy into them. And then I thought, I will construct the narrative as it falls. But I really wanted Banjo and Finlay to be the driving force of it.
That whole interview with Margaret can be found in Read On episode 429. Another author we lost in 2025 was Stella Remington. Dame Stella Remington, the first female director of MI5, and the first head of the spy agency to be publicly named, has died at the age of 90. When she retired from her job in espionage, she became a spy author. And earlier in the year, she joined me on Read On to talk about her latest novel, The Hidden Hand, a Man on Tyler adventure. During that interview, I asked her about her career. Do you think, looking back, you would ever imagine that you'd become the Director General at that time?
Well, no, obviously not. I mean, I never imagined that I would be allowed to become an officer, let alone the Director General, because there was really quite severe segregation. But anyway, what happened was, as the 70s broke out, effectively, so did Women's Lib. And we, there were one or two of us there by then who had, like me, had degrees and previous jobs at a reasonably senior level. And we got together and sort of discussed this and decided that we weren't going to put up with it. We wrote a round robin letter to the bosses saying, you know, why are we being segregated in this way? And we've got just as good education as the men, and da 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 da. And they didn't know what to do, actually, because they came from the tradition where their wives stayed at home and did the flowers and made the house beautiful and all those things. And we were here, these sort of uppity women demanding to be professional people. So they didn't know what to do. And in the end, they decided they had to give some of us a chance. And I was the first one to be allowed to go on the course, which was supposed to teach you the skills that you needed to recruit and run human sources, which are one of the fundamental sources of intelligence, of course. So that was me setting out on my career. So I was allowed then to move up into the officer grade. And later on, after a bit of experience going out with the men, I was allowed to recruit and run human sources of my own. So that was the start of my career. And from then on, really, this division between men and women broke down, actually. And we were treated basically the same as any young person coming in from somewhere else or straight from the university or whatever. And in the end, I became assistant director, running a sort of small team. And then I became a director, first of all, of counter-espionage, which was an important post because, as I said before, espionage, particularly Russian espionage, was the main threat in those days. And then I moved to counter-terrorism, which by then, we're talking now about, you know, towards the end of the 70s, by then, terrorism was beginning to sort of show itself as the main threat, beginning, as far as we were concerned, with Northern Ireland, and then moving on to terrorism from all kinds of sources. So it was a busy job. I took it a few days before Pan Am 103, the American airline that was brought down by a bomber over Lockerbie in Scotland. So that threw me in at the deep end. And so I went on. And then eventually I became deputy director general. And then when the director general retired, I became director general. So that was my route up through the service, that course from part-time typist in Delhi to director general. It took 17 years.
In the last few years of Dame Stella's life, her eyesight was fading and she joined R&IB Talking Books.
I listen to audiobooks all the time because my eyesight is now, I've got macular degeneration, and my eyesight has now reached the point where I actually can't read print or anything very much, actually, because I don't know, I've got glasses, but it doesn't terribly help. The print sort of floats around and my two eyes don't sort of meet very well, I think. So everything's blurred. So I do have great difficulty in reading. So the books are an absolute marvel, as far as I'm concerned. I was registered as partially sighted about a year ago, I think it was. And since then, I joined then the Talking Books. As I say, I am hardly off them in my leisure hours. So they're a huge boon to me. And thank you very much for that.
Dame Stella Remington, author and the first female director of MI5, who has died at the age of 90.
I've been involved in the Talking Book service for a long time, since I was just starting out as an actor.
Julian Fellows on supporting Talking Books.
I suppose what draws me to it is that my whole life has been based around the word, you know, as an actor and then a screenwriter and a novelist and everything else, and the thought of being deprived of the word is terrifying to me. But also what it is really crucial to the Talking Book service is it makes blind people autonomous. You want to get back some of the pleasures that you knew before, and the one that can come back 100% unqualified is reading a book, and that is because of the Talking Book service.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Flesh by David Saloy is described as a propulsive, hypnotic novel about a man who is unravelled by a series of events beyond his grasp. The audio version is read by Daniel Wayman.
After a while, another car comes along the track from the opposite direction. It's a small Suzuki Jeep with Croatian plates.
Wait here, Erdern says. Keep your eyes open.
He walks towards the Jeep, which has stopped. Two men get out and they talk. They seem to be speaking English, but they talk in quiet voices and István can't hear what they're saying. He can't see them very well either in the dusky light. He just stands there, with his hands in his pockets, feeling cold. His feet, especially, feel very cold. He's wearing the wrong sort of shoes. He looks down at them, and at the half-frozen mud of the track. About a week ago, he ran into Erdurn in the town. He knew him slightly from the Young Offenders Institution. Erdurn seemed pleased to see him, and asked did he want to earn some money. István asked him what he meant. Erdurn explained that he had to pick some stuff up in Croatia and needed someone to go with him. Why? István asked. To watch my back. What stuff? István asked. Whatever. That's not important. Why do you need someone to watch your back? So that I feel safe. Why wouldn't you feel safe? I'd feel safer with someone like you with me. What do you mean, someone like me? You know what I mean, Erdurn said. And it's true that István had made a sort of name for himself in the institution. Like everyone in there, he had had to look out for himself. There were some fights. He had an aptitude for fighting, he discovered. That's probably what Erdurn was talking about. When he told István how much he would pay him, István said he would do it. And now he's here, in the cold wood, hugging himself and trying to hear what Erdurn is saying to those two men about 50 metres away, in the half-darkness under the trees.
Flash is, basically, it's the story of more or less the whole life of a Hungarian character called István, and it begins when he's 15 and living on a sort of council estate in a Hungarian town with his mother, and it follows him for decades after that. All kinds of things obviously happened to him, but I guess most notably, or the biggest sort of single aspect of his life that the book covers, is he moves to England, to London, and spends many years there. So it's a story of a Hungarian man emigrating to London, in essence, but I hope it's much more than that too.
Erdurn comes back with a bag, a sort of nylon sports hold-all. He puts it in the car and then reverses along the track the way they came. What is it? István asks, blowing into his hands. Drugs. Whatever, Erdurn mutters. He's twisted round in his seat, reversing along the track which is too narrow for him to turn in. It's nearly dark now. When they reach the main road, which is itself just a quiet, two-lane thing without any traffic, he puts the headlights on. They drive back to the town, and then to a part of it that István doesn't know very well. A few years ago, it was mostly vineyards and fields. Now there are more and more houses on the hillside. They stop at one of them, and István waits in the car while Erdurn rings the doorbell. Who lives there? István asks him when he returns without the hold-all. I don't know, Erdurn says. He pays István his money and drives him home. They do the same thing a few more times that winter, and for a while István has money. He mostly spends it on going out, although the town's nightlife is very limited. The main place is jungle. Sometimes he sees Erdurn there. On one such occasion, when he's drunk, Erdurn tells him that he thinks it's heroin in the bags they pick up. He says that one of the main heroin routes into Europe is through the Balkans, and that this might be part of it. After they've had a few drinks, they talk about taking one of the bags and selling the stuff themselves, if it is heroin. They never do that, though. They never even look in the bags. They're too scared of the man in the house. And also, they're satisfied with the money he pays them for delivering the stuff to him, whatever it is. It seems like a lot to them.
As we were saying before we started the recording, you were last on Read On 9 years ago with All That A Man Is. That they are kind of nine stories that the reader has to link themselves. Are there similarities between that book and Flesh, as in we're linking these little vignettes into your character's life?
Yes, I think there are. I mean, I think All That Man Is was a sort of novel disguised as a collection of stories, you might say, whereas Flesh you could describe almost as a collection of short stories disguised as a novel, because it is a novel in, you know, a traditional sense. It's about one character and follows that character across many years and in a sort of coherent story. But on the other hand, it's made of 10 chapters, which are, as you say, quite self-contained narrative units. So almost, some of them I would say almost could stand on their own as individual pieces of writing, but they are, of course, also part of the larger story. But each chapter covers only a few weeks or months of István's life and is usually separated from the chapters on either side of it by years that we don't really directly see. So yes, there is a sort of, there is a structural similarity with All That Man Is, definitely.
And István travels from Hungary to London. Is that a reverse telling of your own journey?
In a very literal sense, yes. I mean, I grew up in London and lived in Hungary for many years. So yes, I did, when I was sort of contemplating the book, I did very definitely want to write something which had both an English aspect and a Hungarian aspect, because my life at that time was kind of stretched between those two places, I guess. You know, I'd come to a point where I didn't feel 100% sort of at home or based in either place, and I wanted to somehow use that feeling in the book I was about to write. So that was definitely there. I also have relatives who made exactly the same journey as István, in the sense that they, cousins of mine, who grew up in Hungary and moved to England around the time that Hungary joined the EU in 2005, as István does.
Was the book always going to be called Flesh?
No, I mean, Flesh was actually the working title of the book, but somehow there was a sense that it would be replaced by a kind of, I guess, a more elegant or literary title at some stage when the book was finished. But when it time came to actually think of that more elegant or literary title, we couldn't. We couldn't think of anything better than Flesh. I mean, Flesh, although it was quite a sort of rough, almost sort of vulgar, slightly vulgar sounding title, which kind of made people feel slightly uneasy in a way, we decided that those were actually good things about it, and that it really spoke to something deep in the book. And there was a reason, actually, why I had used it as a working title, which I'd done without really spending much time thinking about it. It was just the word that kind of came to hand. So I think it's the best and most appropriate title for the book in the end, yeah.
Flesh is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library and available in all formats commercially, but it's available from RNIB in both audio and braille. And David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For that full interview with David Saloy on his book Flesh, Booker Winner 2025, head to Read On, episode number 450. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, as I said, there's over 450 episodes of Read on the Read On podcast feed. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.